The lessons learned and not learned since Vietnam. Since the war in Vietnam, the U.S. has sent troops to fight in a number of fronts, most recently Iraq and Afghanistan. What have we learned from those wars, and what mistakes do we continue to make? How will history see the U.S. role in these wars? I'm Keith Shortall, and today on Maine Calling, we'll look back 50 years ago when the first ground combat troops were deployed to Vietnam and hear two experienced points of view on the U.S. foreign policy since then. We'll look at some of the common themes among these conflicts and what they say about how the U.S. defines its national interests and decides to defend those interests. We'll talk with retired Ambassador Larry Pope and journalist Nick Mills, a veteran of Vietnam and the author of the new illustrated history, The American Experience in Vietnam, Reflections on an Era. And we want to hear from you. First, this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Despite having ended some 40 years ago, the American experience in Vietnam seems seared into the psyche of our nation. But the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are technically over, though still very much in the news, and we thought today would be a good time to talk about what lessons, if any, have been learned between the time that U.S. sent troops to Southeast Asia and today's current events in Central Asia, Afghanistan, and the Middle East, from Iraq to Iran and Syria. With me in our studio, Lawrence Pope. He's a retired Foreign Service officer, one-time ambassador to Chad, the political advisor to General Anthony Zinni at the U.S. Central Command, and serving as charge d'affaires at the American Embassy in Libya after the killing of Ambassador Chris Stevens in Benghazi on September 11th, 2012. He has been a consultant to the Defense Department and the intelligence community. In 2014, he published the Demilitarization of American Diplomacy. Also in the studio with me, Nick Mills. He's the author of Combat Photographer and Karzai. He's a senior writer of the new illustrated history of the Vietnam War, The American Experience in Vietnam, Reflections on an Era. And as always, we want to hear from you. What's your take on the role of the U.S. in Afghanistan, Iraq, or Vietnam? The number here, 1-800-399-3566. Again, that's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And a programming note, tomorrow on MPBN television at 9 p.m., you can watch the first of a slew of programs airing this month about the Vietnam War. Tomorrow's program is My Lai on American Experience. Check the MPBN website for more information on the programs coming up this month. Welcome both of you to Maine Calling.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Ambassador Pope, we'll start with you. There have been many discussions in the decades past about the lessons learned or unlearned from Vietnam, but certainly there are repeating themes that begin in Vietnam and can be traced through these subsequent conflicts or wars. Talk about those, if you would.
Oh, thanks very much, Keith. You know, it's Patriots Day weekend, and so in some sense it's an appropriate time to look back. The events in Lexington and Concord were provoked by a British occupying army in Boston. And it was that army, that occupation army, that mobilized the revolutionary, the Patriots, to rise up in arms against them. In Vietnam and in Iraq and Afghanistan, something similar happened without attempting to sort of make an equation between those very different times and places. People tend to resent foreign occupation. They react badly to it. And that's what happened in each case. In each case, eventually, starting in Vietnam, the nationalist tide abetted by an invasion from the north overcame the government in Saigon that we'd sought to support. In Iraq, we installed a government which has turned out to be incapable of governing the country. And while the jury is still out in Afghanistan, at the end of the day, there will probably have to be some sort of political reconciliation and negotiation to end that conflict. And in all of those cases, there was a measure of nationalist opposition to military occupation, which we as Americans shouldn't find particularly surprising.
And there had been discussion about these heading into each of these wars, and yet it didn't seem to resonate. The whole lessons learned about Vietnam, about underestimating who these people were, about their nationalism. We still believed in these subsequent cases that we could train them militarily, that somehow they would come around and take the form that we wanted them to take. It never happened.
No, the illusion about military training is a common thread in all three conflicts. In all three conflicts, we spent billions of dollars and many, many years attempting to train local armies. The problem was that in each case, the legitimate use of force by a national army has to proceed from a government which has perceived itself to be legitimate. And in the case of Vietnam and Iraq, that was lacking, and I would argue probably insufficient in Afghanistan.
Nick Mills, what's your take on the themes that run through these conflicts?
Well, it's interesting what the ambassador said about the bringing the Revolutionary War into the conversation, because in all of these cases, it was an indigenous insurgency going against an occupying military. And we have been the occupying military in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in Vietnam. And we were fighting basically indigenous insurgencies. And we still haven't learned not to do that, because it never seems to work. It never seems to come out right. And I appreciate the comment about the failure to raise an army of our making in someone else's country. In all of those cases, it really hasn't worked very well at all, because there was no sense of loyalty to a national structure, to a government that they could respect and want to support. You know, the government in Saigon was as corrupt as anything on the planet at the time. The government that we installed in Iraq was equally corrupt. And I think Afghanistan was rated one of the two most corrupt countries on earth after a few years of our occupation.
So is it that our memory isn't good? There's certainly been enough history around this to read and to learn from. So what has happened? Where's the disconnect? Why do we keep repeating this trend?
Do you have the answer for that, Ambassador?
I wouldn't attempt it, Nick. You know, I remember at the end of 2000, as the Iraq War sort of loomed on the horizon, I was down working at the U.S. Central Command with General Tony Zinni, and he had he'd been a captain. He'd served two tours in Vietnam, been a company commander in Vietnam. He had incorporated that Vietnam experience in his bones. And so when the issue of the invasion of Iraq came up, General Zinni was extremely anxious to sort of think through what would happen, not during the military occupation, because he thought that, as in fact happened, the Iraqi army would fold like a cheap suit, as he used to like to say. But he was concerned about the aftermath. How would we govern the country? How would we run the place? What would be the concept of operations like that? And so he put together an extensive sort of war game in Washington involving the State Department and the CIA and the Defense Department and the military, of course, to try to think this through. And it gave rise to a binder with lots of lessons and thoughts. But when the time came, they were simply thrown out of the window because the assumptions on which they were based were said to be questionable, and he turned out to be quite right.
So, and if you look back at Vietnam, some would make the case that the conventional understanding of the reasons for getting into Vietnam have been questioned over the years. That is the domino theory, this fear that communism was spreading through these former colonial nations, and that we had to do something about it. Some have made the case, there may have been leaders in Washington who maybe knew that this wasn't the case, or knew that the war was unwinnable, but did it anyway for whatever reasons. Is another theme here then a sense that there's was deception upon the American people in these conflicts?
Well, deception, probably self-deception in some cases, too. I mean, we should have listened to Ho Chi Minh in 1945 when he declared the independence of Vietnam after the defeat of the Japanese. And he used the words of our Declaration of Independence, which he admired greatly. There were Americans on the stage with him in Hanoi as he announced it. But within weeks, the United States decided, and Europe decided, no, we've got to give it back to France. And that was a huge mistake. Ho Chi Minh really admired the United States. He worked in the United States for a time. And he was tirelessly fighting for independence from France. And if we had listened to him at the time, we could have avoided many years of bloodshed for Vietnam and for ourselves, especially for Vietnam. But no, we didn't listen to him. We had this cockamamie theory about the dominoes falling. And look what happened after we left Vietnam, right? The North Vietnamese took over. They established. Who was the first war they fought after that? China. The Khmer Rouge, who took power in Cambodia, thanks largely to our illegal bombing of Cambodia. Who knocked them out of power? The Vietnamese. So far from being dominoes, they were anything but.
And Larry Pope, the conventional wisdom at the time also was that, well, Ho Chi Minh is simply a puppet of the Soviets, and that in some way this was a surrogate war with the Soviets. But Ho Chi Minh actually did this revolution kind of on his own. There were connections mm-hmm. later on, obviously. But did we misread that, or did we know it and sort of ignore it?
No, he was of course a dyed-in-the-wool communist and a dedicated communist. And I think we knew that, and we were right about that. But what we lacked at the time, we'd had a purge of, this is one factor among many, obviously, but we'd had a purge in the State Department of our China hands, our Asian experts, over allegations that they lost China by Senator McCarthy and others. And a number of them had been, and some of the most senior China hands had been hounded into retirement and forced out of the State Department. So we lost that expertise that might have served as a corrective had they still been around. And I guess there may be some parallels today with regard to Iraq. And, I talked in the book that you mentioned about the deterioration of our diplomatic institutions, and that's something that worries me in the future.
And I think to put in a word for Ho Chi Minh, I think he was far more a nationalist than a communist. I think he was a pragmatic communist and much more a nationalist. He was really concerned with independence. I mean, Vietnam had been occupied for a long, long time, 1,000 years by the Chinese, and then by the French for 100 years or almost 100 years, and also by the Japanese during the war. So it was his sense of nationalism that kept him going more than his communist credo.
You can be both, I would think, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Nick? Yeah.
Did we know at the time, as one historian put it, that they were, that is the North Vietnamese, were willing to suffer and to take a bigger beating than we were willing or able to shell out?
Oh, yeah. And, General Westmoreland, who was in charge of Vietnam through a lot of those years, couldn't believe the casualties that North Vietnam was willing to accept. And later on, when Defense Secretary McNamara went back, I forget the year that he went to North Vietnam and he sat with General Giap and they discussed the war. And McNamara said, we could have better communication early on might have avoided this tragedy. And General Giap said, well, maybe a tragedy for you, but it was not for us. We won and we got our country back. And we would have fought, to the last man if necessary.
Some have said that in addition to the deaths and injuries, the casualties that the U.S. suffered in the Vietnam War was a near fatal blow to the American public's confidence in government. Some would say in the military. Others have suggested that the more recent wars, the Gulf War and the subsequent wars, have in part been an attempt to regain that. Not solely, there have been interests involved in trying to carry out these wars. But how much of a part of it is that, Larry Pope, do you think? Or is that just a side effect?
Well, you know, the first Gulf War, Keith, in 1991, is said to have done away with the Vietnam Syndrome, and it was a successful military exercise. Our military transformed itself, of course, from that the Vietnam Force, which was partly composed of draftees, to the all-professional, the professional career military service that we have today, which is, I think, justly one of the most admired, perhaps the most admired, of American institutions. So there's been a transformation there, but the fundamental problem remained in Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan of saddling the military with a fundamentally political task it couldn't accomplish. So we've transformed our military into a remarkably professional institution, widely admired in American society. But the question is, the problem that presents is there's a temptation to use it for things that it's not well suited for, political tasks fundamentally.
So how much of then Iraq and Afghanistan were for political reasons, to show the world that we would not sit back and be attacked, that we still are a military might and can demonstrate this?
Attacked? We were not attacked. We attacked Iraq, and I have yet to puzzle out the reason for the attack on Iraq. I have no idea why the Bush administration chose to invade Iraq. So we were not attacked. We were attacked by basically a group of Saudi Arabians who flew planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. So we were not attacked. And the Army, as Ambassador Pope says, was not equipped to go in and take on this task of nation building, which we quickly realized that we had to do because we had broken the old one. In Afghanistan, it was broken already. The Taliban were in control of Afghanistan at the time when we jumped in after 9/11. So two very different situations, but with sort of similar outcomes. And interestingly, you know, we were training an indigenous insurgency in the 1980s when the Soviet Union occupied Afghanistan, and we were training the Mujahideen and arming the Mujahideen. And I think some of those guys are the same ones that we are now fighting against today in Afghanistan.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. The number to join the conversation is 1-800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Bridgeton Hospital, serving the Lakes region of Western Maine since 1917. Proud partners of the Central Maine Medical Family, bridgetonhospital.org. And Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco.
On the next Fresh Air, Toni Morrison. Her new novel, God Help the Child, is about a dark-skinned girl born to light-skinned parents.
I hate to say it, but from the very beginning in the maternity ward, the baby, Lula Ann, embarrassed me.
Morrison talks about her book, her life, and getting older. She's 84. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
You know, public radio is not exactly a business. You can't walk into a grocery store and say, I'll take that lobster there, how much? And the grocer answers, help yourself, pay whatever it's worth to you. Well, that's how we operate in public radio. We don't expect that you pay market price for listening to the radio. What would that be? We have no idea. We just rely on you, and you can rely on us to continue to bring you news and music and the services you get from MPBN. So help keep this unusual arrangement going and make a donation during MPBN's Super Thursday one-day membership drive, and thank you.
You can support MPBN Radio on Super Thursday, April 30th.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, looking back at the wars of the last 50 years, with me in our studio, retired Foreign Service Officer Lawrence Pope. He served as political advisor to General Anthony Zinni at the U.S. Central Command. His most recent book is The Demilitarization of American Diplomacy. Nick Mills taught journalism at Boston University for 26 years, trained journalists in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere, and is a strategic communications consultant. His new book is The American Experience in Vietnam, Reflections of an Era. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to the phones in a moment. I think I asked this question already about why are we doing this? And Ambassador Pope, you'd mentioned there in some of these cases there'd been a depletion of skill, mm-hmm. At the State Department in terms of or the Foreign Service in the diplomatic realm of specialists who understand the culture, the history, the motivations of these populations. But is that it? I mean, or is it just that our memories are so short that the generations are new and are less affected by Vietnam, for example, that acceptance is... I'm trying to get at why do we keep doing the same thing over and over again?
Well, obviously, the decline of diplomatic expertise doesn't explain everything by any means. It's one cause among many. The circumstances are different in each case, aren't they? In the case of the Vietnam War, we were engaged in a global conflict with the Soviet Union, a Cold War in which Vietnam was said to be a football, and Nick has explained eloquently why that has proven not to be the case at all. So the strategic rationale was faulty. In the case of Afghanistan, we were attacked from Afghanistan by a terrorist group based there, which we successfully ejected, and intervened in a civil war that was roughly poised between two contending factions to install one in Kabul. And then morphed into a nation-building effort, as Nick has mentioned. In the case of Iraq, there were a variety of motivations, weapons of mass destruction that turned out to be absent were certainly among them. But one thing we didn't do in any of those cases was to think through the aftermath, think through the political objectives that we have. War is always an atrocity. Sometimes a necessary one, but we owe it to our veterans and those who've served, and particularly to those who to the memory of those who fell, to think these things very, very carefully through before we engage in military force. In each case, these wars. We're dealing with wars of choice, not wars of necessity. The possible exception, or what I would say is a possible exception, being the attack from Afghanistan by al-Qaeda. But in each case, these are wars of choice.
Yeah. Nick, any thoughts before we...
Sometimes I think we've never gotten over World War II and the feeling that we're invincible and we can win any war that we enter. And we did get into these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and Vietnam with no clear understanding of how we'd get out. Mm. And we still can't get out of Afghanistan. We still seem to be going back into Iraq. So, you don't get into those things without knowing or have clear objectives and know how and when to get out. And, it's a mug's game. You can't jump in there and expect that you're going to have a surrender ceremony on the deck of an aircraft carrier. It's not going to work.
Let's go to the phones now to Kathy and Waldo. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Nope, it's afternoon by now. Interesting program you have here. I would like to say, first of all, that if the media in this country had been willing to carry the kind of things that are said today by Ambassador Pope and General Zinni, we might not, because I feel that the level of ignorance on the part of American society, power, that because they are easily propagandized, and the media goes right along with the government propaganda in an patriotism and keeps on board with their newscast.
Kathy, I'm sorry to cut you off, but your cell is cutting out, and I think we got the gist. And I'm going to ask Nick Mills to respond to that. Was this the weak media that contributed to the administration getting to message what it wanted to, unchecked?
Yeah, I think so, because the mass media, the news media, let's say, kind of went along with whatever claims the administration was making about the dangers of Iraq, didn't question it too closely because there were people who would brand any news report, news service as unpatriotic if you dared to question the motivations and the actions of the administration. I think it was a cowardly media for, to some extent.
So, but on the question of the weapons of mass destruction, yeah, for example, it was pretty hard for anyone, I guess, including Congress, to get the information on this.
Yeah, except that there had been inspectors in there for years, and they said, no, there aren't any weapons of mass destruction. Sorry, but somehow the Bush administration, with its X-ray vision, was able to find them or see them when no one else could.
Yeah. Larry Pope, thoughts on the media's role?
Well, much as I'd like to climb on board with criticism of the media, since it always makes a good scapegoat, doesn't it, Keith?
Yeah.
In 1998, the Congress, Senate and House, both adopted a resolution that made it American policy to engineer the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. That resolution passed on both sides of the Hill by overwhelming majorities. We didn't at that time envision an invasion. We thought we would sponsor an exile group and be able to overthrow Saddam Hussein on the cheap. But it was a very popular project, as we tend to forget, on both the progressive left and on the right, the Iraq War, at least elements of the left and the right. And the media, I think, reflected that, as it often does.
Let's go to South Portland and Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on, I think, something that hasn't been discussed yet, and we're talking about the why. And I think a good many clues to why are contained in, it's often been quoted, President Eisenhower's last speech as he was leaving the White House on the military-industrial complex, in which he warned that top military, industrial, and political leaders continue to assure corporate profits and for military-related industries and assure the continued growth of our federal tax dollars being increasingly allocated to the military to the expense of other places where it needs to go. And I think that these, as the previous caller mentioned, these adventuristic wars on our part for profit are supported by the corporate media as well. And I think if we're looking for whys, we need to look at those kinds of motivations.
All right, Bob, thank you. Nick Mills, we have heard this, that these wars support a war machine, an economic war machine. And it has been said in the past that if you want to improve your economy, go start a war. But how much do you see it? Are those factors motivators in these wars that we're talking about today?
It's kind of hard to say. I think it's hard for me to say anyway how much the military-industrial complex, works to say, all right, there's never too much war. Let's have another one because we need to fuel this this military machine and keep the defense contractors. I don't know how much of that is going on, really. It certainly is true that the military-industrial complex does benefit from having conflicts, and but whether that is a design, who's to say? Not me, anyway.
Yeah. Larry Pope?
Well, I'd look less at conspiracies than at in the mirror when we think about what's happened. certainly in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're still a democracy, and we've sent our young men and women in harm's way to represent us and to serve on our behalf. And so I think we owe it to ourselves to take responsibility for that.
Let's go to Kent in Searsport. Hi, Kent.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. I never went to combat. I was in the Marine Corps twice, in the 70s and in the 80s. The first time I was in the infantry at Camp Lejeune. The second time I worked on aircraft at El Toro. The downside about a lot of these things, what people don't ever talk about, I can only speak of myself. I can't speak about other people because I'm not them. What happened to me is I'm one of the poison patriots from Camp Lejeune. Mm. Where they were dumping all the water from the dry cleaners right next to the intake for the whole base. And I've had 7 eye operations since 1977 to try and hold on to my eyesight. Mm. The downside is that the Marine Corps never notified me until over 30 years later that I was poisoned, even though they knew back in 1981-82 when the water was tested. And the only reason they did notify us was because the person that tested the water was so afraid of being sued, and the Marine Corps never acted on it, and after went by for 2 or 3 years and they never acted, then he had notified his local congressman, and then the Congress actually made the Marine Corps notify us. I still haven't been notified from the same thing happening, the same chemicals, except it was dumped by the drinking water at El Toro. They closed the base. They've never notified me for that one. I'm still waiting on that one. That was over 30 years ago. So, you know, we did the same thing with Agent Orange in Vietnam. How long did it take them, all these people that died, how long did it take them to notify those poor people, their poor children, the generation after that? So all these things, like the one gentleman was saying, I'm not sure which one of you said this, but you said we don't take responsibility for our actions. You leave these people out there high and dry, and then you don't take care of them. And now you have all these bitter veterans. Why don't we start the draft? Why don't we share the love for all these people that want to support the government, support the military? Is it right to send somebody to Afghanistan 3 times and Iraq twice? Yeah, I don't think so.
So we're up against the break here. Ken, I appreciate the call. I think at the end, he's clearly lamenting the treatment of veterans, but proposing a draft. I'm not sure how that fits in the context of what we're discussing here, but any thoughts on that, Larry Pope?
Well, there is an issue with a professional military force that it makes it a bit easier to use it than may sometimes be desirable. I think if you asked military professionals themselves, they'd say the last thing they want is to reinstitute the draft. At the same time, there's a danger in having a military service which is culturally more and more distant from the broad the range of the American people. And there's a risk of its overuse in situations where it's not really – not well suited.
So had we used the draft, Nick Mills, I guess, in Iraq and Afghanistan, the public outcry would have been louder?
Yeah, I would hope so. I think that was one of the reasons for the division of American public opinion in Vietnam. There were certainly a lot of draftees. The majority of soldiers in Vietnam were not draftees. Mm-hmm. I think that's a common misconception. But what this guy was talking about, the chemical poisoning of that base and the use of Agent Orange in Vietnam, and there have been chemical contaminations that were uncovered in Iraq, and soldiers were affected by them and were not treated, and the military was in sort of denial that any of that ever existed. I think, you know, the slogan, support the troops. Well, I think the military itself is not supporting the troops well or adequately enough in many cases, and there have been several stories lately about poor treatment in military hospitals, long waits at the VA hospitals for treatment, denial of conditions caused by perhaps Agent Orange and other things that the soldiers encounter in the field.
Yeah, and I'll let Kent respond here before the break because I want to just get back to you quickly. Kent, do you want to add anything?
I pretty much So thanks for letting me blow a little steam. I want to go to the therapist for at least a month now.
Okay. All right. Glad to help.
All right. Thank you. All right. We're going to take another short break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Health, working with member organizations like Nordex to help make our communities the healthiest in America. MaineHealth.org. Goodwill Neuro Rehab Services, helping Mainers with traumatic brain injuries get back to life. Find out more at goodwillnne.org. And Casella, committed to effectively managing non-recyclable waste while protecting the environment. Casella, giving resources new life.
In an ever-accelerating world with ever-faster communication, NPR's Morning Edition slows the news down.
We're going to be doing this all day. Let's work through what happened in what order as best you know right now.
Take a second look, ask one more question, and own your morning. Tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News.
You can join us weekday mornings from 6 to 9 a.m. for Morning Edition. And you're not alone in listening to and supporting MPBN Radio. If you're also on Facebook, join over 18,000 other listeners who are now friends of MPBN. Want to join us? We promise not to bombard you with stuff, but we do share special programming and event news and try to answer any questions you might have about our radio, television, or online services. And we often have questions for and want information from you. So do join us. It's also a great way to connect with other listeners and viewers. If you like MPBN On Air, like us on Facebook, too.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Nick Mills served as an Army officer in Vietnam, leading a combat photo team. He established an Afghan news service, trained Iraqi Kurds in visual journalism, and his new book is The American Experience in Vietnam, Reflections of an Era. Also with us today, former Ambassador Lawrence Pope. He served as ambassador to Chad and was the charge d'affaires at the American Embassy in Libya after the killing of Ambassador Chris Stevens in Benghazi on September 11, 2012. His most recent book, The Demilitarization of American Diplomacy. Join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Peter in Douglas, Arizona. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. A couple of comments. One related to the mystery about why there was a war in Iraq. Does not Iraq have some of the largest oil reserves in the world? Mm-hmm. That might have something to do with it. And then the press falling down on the job. It seemed like the policy of embedding journalists was very wisely chosen. It's very hard not to sympathize with the armed forces in that kind of situation.
Yeah, Nick Mills, was embedding a clever.
It cuts both ways. In places like Iraq and Afghanistan, you're an idiot if you don't embed because it's so dangerous out there. You know, in Vietnam, we were more free range chickens. We could go anywhere and attach to any unit and pull out whenever we wanted, and so. It was the last war in which reporters had the run of the battlefield, so to speak. So the embedding process certainly works in the military's favor because, as our caller pointed out, the reporters tend to identify with the troops more and are more reluctant to write anything critical. But it also is a way to keep the reporter out of harm's way. And I think a lot of any reporter who tries to go on his own in Afghanistan or Iraq is in serious trouble.
Let's go to Constance in Elliott. Hi, Constance.
Hi. I have a concern about throwing our young people and our resources into such destructive enterprises. And it seems to me that we owe a great deal. We need to factor in to the cost of war what happens to our combatants who come home with post-traumatic stress and other horrible illnesses such as the suffering from Agent Orange and things such as parochial as drinking water on a base. So I think a war is a terrible thing, and to hear us praised for having a good killing machine is not something I personally find applaudable.
All right, Constant.
So I guess that summarizes it.
Okay, well, thank you for calling today. Appreciate it. And we'll go now to Ed in Hamden. Hi, Ed.
Hello, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I think you made some very good points. I'm a Vietnam-era veteran myself, and my opinion is, agreeing with the first lady you had on the air, we have an uneducated public. We should never allow these wars. At any break table, you can sit down and discuss sports, movies, cars, music, but you discuss history or current events, and you get looks like you're a bug from the moon. And I think our politicians lied and used propaganda to get into these wars. Johnson couldn't stay out of Vietnam because he didn't want to lose Vietnam, like Truman lost China. He used the domino theory, and Bush number 43 and Cheney lied for whatever reason to justify the invasion. And one common thing to both wars is the peace groups. With the peace groups, they're either weak on communism or weak on terrorism. And these peace groups are vilified, and they just tried to educate the public and not get into this mess. So that's all I have to say.
All right, Ed, thanks very much.
Good point.
Larry Pope, how much of the digging in Vietnam and the policies that happened there were really about Lyndon Johnson? I've read that it was about his insecurities, and he wanted approval. Was he single-handedly there making these decisions while the chiefs of staff sort of remained silent?
It's a complicated issue, and long books have been written about it. I think at one point he's quoted as having said to somebody they'd impeach a guy who pulled out of Vietnam. So he was very concerned about his political exposure.
Yeah. Tell you a little story about LBJ. Right. He had a phone conversation with Robert McNamara, the defense chief, and McNamara and Westmoreland were pushing Johnson to send in combat troops in 1965. And on March 6th of 1965, LBJ and Robert McNamara had a phone conversation, and McNamara was trying to persuade him to send the Marines in to Da Nang to protect the air base at Da Nang. And Johnson was very reluctant. And he said, you know, I know what a Marine is, a guy with a dagger in his hand who plants the flag, and, you know, and we're at war. And the end of the conversation, Johnson said, well, my answer is yes, but my judgment is no. Mm. And 2 days later, the Marines went ashore.
Mm. Yeah.
Let's go to Gray in Hancock. Hi, Gray.
Hi. Thank you for this. I'd like to hear your panelists talk about something that I've never really heard discussed coherently, and that is the so-called greatest generation, which did their job perfectly in World War II, I suppose. But they went through the 30s, the Depression, and World War II, and were suffering from a kind of collective PTSD that was never recognized or treated because they won the war. And when they came back, they wanted to build a peacetime country, and they didn't want to have to worry about anything, and they relied upon the authority figures they had been taught to obey during the war. And they allowed this military mentality to go through the whole country, so that to the point where even today you can't say anything really negative about the military without a large portion of the populace looking askance at you. And there was all these specific things your callers have talked about that I certainly agree with most of them. But aren't the origins of our post-World War II war follies the result of a policy that continued World War II in a different fashion, and we never really got over it, and Congress won't declare war. They allow the president to have military actions, et cetera, et cetera. It's not really the media. They reflect the situation rather than direct it. Anyway, thanks a lot for the show.
All right, thanks, Gray. Larry Pope.
With regard to Congress and the role of Congress, let me just comment that we've had a couple of instances in the last couple of years in which the president has sought an authorization to use military force from the Congress. with regard to the situation first in Syria in 2013 and then Iraq, and that's going on right now. And in either case, in the first case in 2013, after the use of chemical weapons in Syria, the president made a deal with the Russians, and in this current case, it seems to be the Congress that's unable to that's unable to come to a decision with regard to the authorization to use military force. So that the president is still going on with the 2001 post 9/11 authorization. That's kind of a failure of political leadership in a fundamental sense.
Let's go to Jim in Belfast. Hi, Jim. Sorry. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. Yeah, this is Belfast. And I had a top secret clearance for 7 years.
Okay, Jim, we've lost you. See if you can call back and connect on the line there. Your cell was not quite working. Let's go to Larry in Caribou. Hi, Larry.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good, yeah. You know, Smedley Butler, who was a brigadier general in the Marine Corps back around the turn of the 20th century, I think he said it best in his book, which is entitled War is a Racket. Smedley Butler, War is a Racket. This is a brief quote. I spent 33 years in the Marines, most of my time being high-class muscle men, for big business, for Wall Street, and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism. All that's changed is we've gotten better at doing what we were doing 100 years ago, overthrowing governments, occupying nations. This is what the United States does for profit. It's as simple as that.
All right, well, let's...
And to say, why do we do it over and over again? Gee, I don't know. We just like to bang our heads against the wall. So it's for profit. The guys he mentioned. Wall Street, the bankers, the business, big corporations. Nothing changes. I mean, you know, that's the reason we have wars. They're profitable for the 10% or the 1%, whichever way you want to look at it. That's simple.
All right, Larry, thank you for that. So again, I think there is a sense out there among the folks, and including veterans, that this is about money.
Mm. Yeah. Oil, money, the military-industrial complex. There is a lot of circumstantial evidence for that theory.
Smedley Butler is one of my favorite people. He was a veteran of the Banana Wars in Nicaragua and elsewhere, and he thought he'd been fighting to defend United Fruit. I think without agreeing with the caller's premise, there's quite a difference, I think, between the situations we're talking about and those that era of banana wars.
Let's look ahead a little bit. We've done a good job of looking back here as best we can. So how does in future then the U.S. With all this hindsight now, sort of come up with its interests and defend those interests in ways that it does not repeat the same mistakes? It's a big question. I guess what I'm getting at is, what have we learned, Larry Pope, going forward, or should we have learned that we can no longer do?
We are on the brink of what I suppose you could call the third round of the Iraq War. If the first round was 1991, the second was 2003 to 2010, and continuing, we're now on the brink of a new conflict in Iraq with ISIS, this so-called Islamic State, which is neither Islamic nor a state. And it threatens to draw us into a conflict which is on both sides of the Syria and Iraq border. We're bombing with a will in coalition with Iran, in many cases, in Iraq. In Yemen, we're engaged with a coalition which is bombing on the other side against a group of Shia rebels. So I think it behooves us to think very carefully through our objectives as we go forward, bearing in mind the lessons of the past, not reluctant to use force when it's required and can be done so in a sensible way, but reluctant to use it unless in cases of dire necessity.
Nick Mills, final words, 60 seconds.
We've heard these warnings throughout the history of the Republic. Beware of foreign entanglements. Never fight a land war in Asia. And the same could be said of the Middle East. So, again, as Ambassador Pope said, we really have to think not just twice, but thrice and more before getting into these things.
All right. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you, Keith.
Pleasure.
Lawrence Pope, a retired Foreign Service officer. His most recent book is The Demilitarization of American Diplomacy. Nick Mills is the author of Combat Photographer and Karzai, and senior writer of the new illustrated history of the Vietnam War, The American Experience in Vietnam, Reflections of an Era. And don't forget that tomorrow on MPBN Television at 9 p.m., you can watch the first of a series of programs airing this month about the Vietnam War. Check listings for those programs. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Our intern Moses Small answered your calls. And you can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, we check in with legislative leaders to find out about the latest news from what's going on in the session in Augusta. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.